Good morning. I'd like to call to order the Department of Environmental Conservation Subcommittee on the Budget, the operating budget. Today is February 7th, and it is 8:35. And today we have Larry Dietrich with us, the director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. Also here is Tom Cherian. Thank you for joining us, and Jeff Rogers from the department. And if I missed anyone, maybe you can introduce them when you come forward. Okay, I'll just let you do that when you come forward to introduce other staff in your department. And today we have a presentation by Mr. Dietrich, and then Mr. Dietrich will walk us through the budget for his division found on pages 34 through 43. And present, we have Representative Tarr. Thank you for joining us. Representative Higgins, Representative Kawasaki, and Majority Leader Lance Pruitt. Thank you for joining us. And Christopher Clark is staff to the committee. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I may intercede.
Yes.
Thanks to the department, last night we got the responses to questions that were raised in this committee, as well as in the full finance committee by Representatives Lascaro and Scott Kawasaki. I sent them to you last night as links. And right now they're being printed, so sometime in the middle of the meeting I'll be distributing those to you and members of the public. So that's coming if you need them.
And I think Representative Higgins and Tarr also had questions that were posed, so they are part of those responses. All right. Mr. Dietrich, would you like to come forward, please?
Okay, start?
Yes, please.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Larry Dietrich. I'm the Director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the Department of Environmental Conservation. And today I'll go through the division operating budget.
Good.
And we do have a PowerPoint, and I'll make reference. Generally speaking, the order of the PowerPoint is we will go through each of the programs, and then we have a section at the end just on the response funds. There were always questions about the response funds, so we'll cover that as the last item and go through that in whatever detail you may like. And then I'll also point to the page numbers in the purple book as we go through that. They're also on the slides, but I'll make reference as we start each one. So if you want to follow along in the purple books, you can. The numbers on the slides match exactly what's in the purple book. So.
Okay. Does everybody have the PowerPoint?
And the purple book.
And the purple book.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so we'll start out with the first slide. SPAR's mission is to protect public safety, health, and the environment through prevention, preparedness, and cleanup of oil and hazardous substances. That's our broad mission. Our core services, on the second slide, basically these core services are basically also the foundation for our program structure. The first one is to identify and oversee and conduct cleanup, redevelopment, management of contaminated sites. And so we have a contaminated site program that we'll be speaking to. The second core service then deals with industry preparedness, and that's the requirements for industry to have oil spill response contingency plans and financial responsibility for certain regulated entities. And we have an industry preparedness program that carries out that work. The third core service then is our actual response group, and they actually do the actual responses then to spills as they occur and conduct the oversight and or cleanup, containment, removal, and mitigation. And last but not least is the fifth one, and we have a separate program for that. It's a small one, which is just the management of the response fund. The third slide here, just a couple of comments on our leadership. We have a director then, myself, and we have four program managers, one for each of those four programs I just mentioned. We're a little bit aged. There's a total of 159 years of collective experience in the private sector, government. We've got a very diverse group of individuals with an awful lot of experience, which has been very beneficial for us. It also begs succession issues as we move forward as well. And we hire our primary job classes, our environmental specialists, engineers, and technicians. Okay, with that, the next slide then is just a broad overview of our operating budget by fund source. And to be, just to summarize for the whole division budget, we have no organizational changes this year, no amendments, there's no supplemental requests, no increments, no transfers, and no new positions. We're pretty much a continuation level budget for FY14. The pie chart on the left just shows for the whole division our primary funding sources. And then as we go through each program, we will identify each of the funding sources for those programs and talk about what that money buys. Next slide here is on our budget detail for our operating requests. This shows how our various funding sources are broken out by the programs. I'll start with the small green slice there is the director's office. We don't have a separate slide on it. There's two people in the director's office, myself and a clerical staff. The response fund administration is a small group. Then we have our response group, our industry preparedness group, and then our contaminated site program, which is the largest of the programs in the division. So that gives you an idea overall how the money is allocated within the division. Next slide, I'll start commenting now on the individual programs. So the first one here is in contaminate site program, and that is on pages 36 and 37 of the purple book. The format for the programs we've laid out here is the same. So first I will cover our responsibilities and challenges, and then we'll end with the budget detail for each of the programs. The contaminate site program manages the cleanup of contaminated sites in the state of Alaska. Our focus is on reuse and redevelopment of those sites and getting them back into active use. Some of our sites are difficult, particularly if they're groundwater situations. It's either technically or economically not feasible in many cases to do the kinds of cleanups to get down to zero contamination. So we use a risk-based approach. We use exposure pathways. And we have a number of tools then that we use to rank and prioritize sites for cleanup. Some of the challenges in this program are the groundwater contamination is the biggest challenge, and we have some fairly significant groundwater contamination issues in Alaska that we're working on. Those are the most difficult. And another challenge then is changing cleanup standards. The science is always changing, so the cleanup levels for different contaminants are in an ever-changing evolution as more science comes in and then new numbers become available. And so the problem becomes how do we apply those to historic sites that may have been closed out, you know, under a different number. This slide, next slide, shows overall the contaminated site situation in the state. The blue bars are the number of sites that we've actually closed out and completed over time. It's approaching 4,600. The orange sites are sites that have some kind of work to be done on them yet. It's either assessment, cleanup, or monitoring of the work. Many of our sites in Alaska are from legacy sites, what we call legacy contamination. So they're contamination issues that occurred before programs even existed or EPA even existed or even DEC existed. Mine sites, for example, use mercury in the state of Alaska regularly. And there's something like 4,000 mine sites on the records in the state. We have some where the mercury is a fairly serious threat, and others they haven't even been inventoried yet. Past logging activities in pulp plants have created part of the legacy problem. Fuel storage and the handling of petroleum project is a huge proportion. 80% of our contaminated sites are petroleum contamination. The Cold War, the dew line sites present problems. A lot of our contamination from World War II activities out in the Aleutians. The state used to have 7,000 underground storage tanks in Alaska, and there was a 10-year cleanup program to correct that problem. 6,000 of them were cleaned up and closed in Alaska. We now have about less than 1,000 underground storage tanks left in Alaska, and about 600 where prior leakage from underground storage tanks remains as a contamination issue. Some of the other sources have been seafood processing, power plants. I think the legislators are aware of the 137 oil wells and NPRA in the federal government has that were ever properly abandoned. Federal facility contamination of federal facilities comprises over 50% of the contaminated sites that we deal with. We also have quite a few eroding landfills and coastal situations and rivers that pose an immediate threat. 75% of our spills are to land, which is what results in contaminated sites and subsurface contamination, which makes these difficult cleanup issues. Just a brief slide here on how we approach this. I mean, you have a source, a contamination source, and then you have a pathway to a receptor, such as somebody living in a house. There's many ways to approach these things. In many cases, you cannot actually clean up the contamination, but you can break the pathway. And we do a lot of that work now. You look at the mechanism by which the contaminant can be transported then to somebody who is either drinking the water or is living in a house and may be subject to vapors coming off from contaminants under their house that are in the water table. And we break that pathway. It doesn't mean you get the site cleaned up, but if you restrict the pathway so that the people aren't exposed to contaminant, that's another way to mitigate the problems. Next slide is, this is just some of the accomplishments from, these numbers and information is for the last fiscal year. So that gives you an idea of what the program does. We had assessment, cleanup, or monitoring or closure activities at about 1,200 contaminated sites. We used risk reduction measures at about 154. We've done site review and risk evaluations at 161 new sites. One of the reuse sites that was completed this last year that had been under the way for a while was the Kincaid Park, which was a former gun range and lead contamination, and that got completed, and we have two soccer fields there now. We've got area-wide groundwater issues in both Fairbanks and Kenai that are very difficult technical-type issues. And we're evaluating the new science after the new cleanup standards. The next slide deals with two of the performance measures then that we use for contaminated sites. The first one we use to, the goal is to restore about 150 sites per year. That's our target line, and you can see the bar there. And we're, our attempt there is to get sites restored for use, get them back on building lists, allow property transactions to go forward, and not have them be limited for use in any way because of the contamination issues. The second measure deals then with exposure pathways. That's another way to mitigate the risks. And the goal there is to eliminate, break the pathways for contamination to people for about 700 pathways a year is our target number. That doesn't mean that the sites are all closed up, but it means we've mitigated the risk. Okay, the last slide then for Contaminate Sites program, and again, I'd reference page 36 and 37. The numbers on this slide are right off of the purple book, and so it shows the funding sources now for this program, the total operating request of $8.3 million. The response fund contribution here is $3.7 million. The other state funds is, these are funds we get from other agencies to oversee their cleanups. In this particular case, the 92.3 other state funds actually comes to us via the Army National Guard for cleanups associated with their facilities. And then the federal receipts, which is a very big chunk, and again, over 50% of our sites are from are either military federal facilities or civilian federal facilities. And so that $4.5 million is made up of, there's $468,000 in federal funds for leaky underground storage tanks. There's a certain amount, about $750,000 for brownfield sites. $3.4 million comes through DOD for cleanup of federal military sites. There's money from the federal government via the Corps and BLM. And that's the budget profile for contaminated sites.
Madam Chair. Yes, Representative Tarr. Would you like us to hold, thank you, would you like
you're
to hold questions?
You're welcome to answer,
okay.
Ask questions.
On this contaminated sites program, in terms of site identification, is any of that happening as a result of health effects in the local community or, you know, nearby? And if so, is there any collaboration with Department of Health and Social Services to sort of track that information for trends or anything?
Yes, Representative, through the chair, the we consult frequently and often with health and social services, and toxic disease registry people and other medical people on our more difficult sites where we may have a direct public health exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Our big one in Fairbanks right now is with a contaminant that we haven't wrestled with before. It's for sulfalene. It's extensive, and we've invested heavily in examining. There is no drinking water standard, for example, for sulfalene.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had to consult, just as you've indicated, with outside medical experts from a variety of organizations, including EPA, Health and Social Services, and others, CDC, to establish a level then for the cleanup that would protect people that are using that water.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Higgins.
When we go and do clean up a site on a federal installation, is the are they paying 100% of that bill, or are we splitting it with them?
Yes, Representative Higgins, through the chair. Federal facilities, they pay 100% of our oversight costs. So the answer, I think, is yes, and then we also apply an indirect on top of that for our overhead. And that's negotiated with each federal, civilian, or military organization that has a liability or contaminated property that they own that they have to get cleaned up. There's a very broad, what we call a statement of cooperation with all the civilian federal agencies that actually sponsors the Alaska Forum in the Environment. That's how that got started, was through state-federal cooperation to get these federal facilities jointly cleaned up, and include a process of identifying them, triaging them, ranking them by risk, and then they're put into the queue, and this program then negotiates with each one so that the costs for doing the cleanup are inserted into the federal budget. When it's inserted into the federal budget, it includes the state's cost component, and then they pass that money through to us.
Thank you.
And could we let the record show that Representative Seaton has joined us, please? Thank you. Are there further questions? I have a question on the public notice, or how do you get the word out to the community surrounding a contaminated site that a particular site is unsafe? I mean, I was surprised by the number of, for instance, some old mining sites that you said many of those old mining sites are near recreational trails, and yes. In fact, those are probably the reasons why those many of those trails were there, to access the mine. So how do you get the word out to the public?
Madam Chair, we have on our website, we have a list of all these contaminated sites are in a database that's available on the website with all known information about that site. And we built that and try to keep it up to date as best we can, just so that people can access it readily. It was originally developed and designed to meet the banker's needs in real estate transactions. As you know, if you do a property transaction now, there's a disclosure requirement mm-hmm. that the seller has to make about whether or not you got oil and hazardous substance or other. And so banks check our website now to see if any particular property is included in that database just mm-hmm. for that purpose. So that's the broad way in which we make the information available. It's not to say, though, that all of the inventories of all the sites have been completed, like the 4,000 mine sites.
Mm-hmm.
That's partially inventoried at this point. And usually we go to DNR, BLM records for that to find out where all the old patents were. And it'll be a number of years before all of those are looked at, determined if there are risks, and then added to the database. We have some now, but we're not at the end. In addition, then, for our higher profile cases, we actually do newsletters and updates. And there's a site, what we call a site summary, on the website. So for any given site where there's actually a problem and ongoing work, you can actually see the work that's going on, and it's in chronological order, so you can see the progression and if an assessment was done and they're doing cleanup now, or if they're just mm-hmm. going to monitoring and so on and so forth.
Okay. Representative Tarr.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just one last question on the contaminated sites. The above ground storage tanks, was a lot of that money coming through the Denali Commission before to replace those, and how is the federal funding, if that's true, how has that federal funding situation changed, you know, the status of getting those taken care of?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, the Denali Commission, there was a program at one time where the late Senator Stevens, when the Oil Pollution Act passed in 1990,
mm-hmm.
Prior to that act, there was a $500 million insurance liability pool for spills in that area. That was displaced by OPA when they set up the National Oil Spill Fund. The state contributed to that fund,
mm-hmm.
and so there's a part of that principle is an account that generates interest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that interest flow stream was the money that was used to go clean up sites that these above ground storage tanks in mostly in remote Alaska, where they had spills and problems and were out of compliance with the federal law.
Mm-hmm.
That program is, we were involved with it initially, and it's now run by the Division of Energy, and I believe all of that money does flow, as you indicate, through the Denali Commission now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of course, the you know, ounce of prevention, the pound of cure kind of thing. What are we doing instead of just looking at existing contaminated sites across industrial uses as well as residential and commercial uses to assess the potential for spills or not strictly, you know, production from oil, but all of the other things, sulfalene or whatever. How are we approaching that on a broad spectrum to go in and look at what are the potentials for future contamination, and do we have any mechanism for requiring tank inspections or you know, if it's solid, whether there's runoff protection and those kind of things?
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes, there's several things I think being done in that arena. There are certain facilities that are regulated then that have prevention requirements have to be applied, and so those are looked at very carefully, and the potential for spills, and if there are problems, they're dealt with straight away. Unregulated facilities, less so, because they're not subject to prevention requirements. Our spill data shows that 75% of the spills reported in the state are from the unregulated portion of the facilities. So we don't always know if they're having a problem or not, but the contaminated site program does have what they call a site intake program. So if we don't already know about it, but if a spill or whatever is brought to our attention, then it goes through the site intake program, which puts it in the queue then to be assessed, investigated, to determine if there is a risk there that we need to deal with. Our emergency response program responds to all spills. And if they don't get them cleaned up and closed out at the end of the emergency response, then they are handed off the contaminate site program then for further work. We're probably not covering all the bases, but there is a process there. And the high-risk facilities, I would say, are covered pretty well. We look after those where the high spill potential is and the biggest risk for contamination.
A follow up, and I guess if 75% of the contaminations are from unregulated,
mm-hmm.
I guess although you can have a high risk facility that has to have a contingency plan and prevention plan, but if 75% of what we're seeing is contamination is coming from unregulated, do we have a mechanism or do we need a net mechanism? Do you in DEC have a proposal for us to how we could inform the unregulated entities of what their liabilities are and mm-hmm. all of those kind of, I'm trying to get to, if not in magnitude of an individual spill, but in the volume of contaminated sites, if 75% of them, we really need to somehow have some program to stop those from becoming contaminated, you know.
Yes. Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. When you look at the state's spill prevention response requirements in the regulated community, the sectors that are added to that spill safety net and become regulated are usually event-driven. So, for example, it started out with the crude oil industry, but then we had some serious freighter spills in Selandang, Iu, and Kirishima. So that drove legislative approval then to include what we call non-tank vessels, which is all boats over 400 gross tons, have been brought now into that safety net. Meth labs have been added to our plate, the Alaska Railroad. So we have key events, and that's usually an event is usually a key driver then for formally changing the statutes to include other sectors into the network. And other things, for example, that are not regulated right now are like home heating oil fuel tanks. They're, if you have a spill, they still have to clean them up. But we're at a point now where a lot of the construction in the state was in the 70s, like the Mendenhall Valley or Fairbanks that are on oil. They got buried tanks. These tanks are 25 or 30 years old. They have potential for a lot of spills. So for that sector, which is otherwise not regulated, and for like harbors where we have a lot of problems, but the harbors aren't otherwise regulated, we have volunteer non-regulated prevention programs, is I guess the way to characterize them. So we have a website. We tell you how to design fuel tanks, tell you how to avoid the spills. We have the Green Harbors program now, which I think Homer was the first one to get certified. So there's some non-regulatory actions that were taken to try to deal with the sectors that aren't otherwise formally regulated to do just what you're saying, to prevent spills and make sure we don't get more contaminated issues in the future.
And in Homer, we just had another one of these, which was two vessels that were derelict vessels and were taken out over, it happened to be in Jackloff Bay across from Homer, because they weren't allowed into the Homer Harbor because they were, you know, in situation that everybody could see this is not a good process. So they went over there, snow event, they sunk. There was fuel, bulk fuel, other stuff as well coming off of those. So does DEC have any proposed regulations, since we've got all of these? I mean, it's every harbor around the state is experiencing the same thing, and people, there were a lot of big, larger buyback vessels in the Bering Sea that are now in our harbors, and they're being sold to non-financially responsible parties, whether for a houseboat or whatever, and then it ends up sinking and becoming a huge burden on the state. And so does DEC have any proposals or suggestions on how to move forward to alleviate that program, that from happening?
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. These type of vessels, like you mentioned there in Jackaloff Bay, are not regulated by the state or the federal government, don't have to have sea plans. Our rule sets a 400 gross ton, which is a boat, you got to be about over 150 or 200 feet to be captured. So the bulk of like the fishing fleet in Alaska is not regulated. So the programs that are in place right now is if they have a spill, they get responded to. So for Jackaloff Bay, both the state and the Coast Guard responded. The federal government opened up the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. Global Diving and Salvage is out there to hazmat, what we call hazmat the boat. They were sunk. So they get the oil and hazmats off, and then DNR stepped in because it was a trespass case, and they actually arranged then after Global got done and had them towed to Homer. Do we have a formal program for derelict vessels or sunken vessels in Alaska? Not beyond the emergency response thing. And there is a very large number of sunken vessels in Alaska that potentially pose a threat. The Princess Kathleen out here in Juneau was the first sunken vessel with oil on it where the federal government opened up the fund and actually did a pump out to remove that. And that was a $12 million complex operation with, it was all submerged diving. They got it off. The boat's still there. There are many similar type vessels in Alaska for which there is no formal program, I guess.
Can I have one?
Sure.
We're trying to work on the prevention of those instead of cleaning them up. And the thought was looking at a statute that would say that if a vessel is denied entrance into a harbor because of its condition, that before it could be stored for over 2 weeks in state waters, all hazardous materials would have to be removed. Mm-hmm. Would that be something that DEC would generally support as a way, so if something does sink, at least we're not having hazardous materials coming off, and it could be handled in a, instead of on an emergency basis trying to work around ice and get something out of the water to, so you're not having a spill, at least it could be handled in a time frame that would make the raising of vessels and cleanup much more efficient.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair, DEC would be happy to participate in something like that. There are other people, entities would have to be brought in. DOT has some authority in the harbors themselves. DNR has a trespass authority. NOAA is actually doing an inventory of the sunken vessels in Alaska, and they have actually have a risk system now they've developed on how to rank these. So to get where you're going there, I think we'd want to bring those people in and then discuss and what the best approach would need to be in order to isolate what kind of state authority then would be needed to enhance that, you know, such that we could advance something like that.
Okay, and thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up, what we're trying to do at this point in time is prevent the sinkings.
Yes.
With hazardous waste on board. And, I don't know that we can prevent someone from anchoring in state waters, but I think that we could, under certain circumstances, say it can only be anchored with certain conditions, and that would be removing the, mm-hmm. the bulk fuels and the batteries and the other hazardous waste that would be there. So I would really like, as we go forward, to separate the prevention from the inventory of sunken vessels and how we're going to clean those up, because
right.
if that's that is a huge fiscal note, whereas the other could be just a regulatory process. So thank you, Ms. Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. And you might address this later on in the presentation, but I understand that the prevention aspect, but on the actual contaminated sites cleanup, how effective is the Attorney General and the Department in recuperating or recovering costs for something like that? If it's $12 million and federal government helped pitch in some of that, we use some of our own, I mean, somebody's got to be held accountable mm-hmm. for that particular spill. Will you explain some of those numbers, maybe?
Yes, Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, when we get to our response fund program, we'll cover some detail on it, but generally speaking, we're a strict liability state, so the spiller is responsible. And the statute requires us to seek cost recovery in all those cases, and that's what we do to the best of our ability. Our recovery rate is it's hard to measure, because you have an event like we just got the settlement for the 2006 BP incident. Well, it's 2013, so there's a lag, but I'd say we're running between 80 and 100% recovery rates. Some years we do better than others.
Thank you.
Do the settlement monies go back into the fund?
Madam Chair, yes, they go into the statute directs that settlement funds, fines, and penalties and our state costs be deposited in what they call the prevention mitigation account. And I'll cover that when we get to the response fund. There's actually six accounts, but that's where those are required to
okay.
be placed.
And the response fund is funded through the tax on the barrel of oil? Is that? $0.04?
Yes, that's one of the revenue streams, and there are others. And okay. when we get to that chart, I will.
Okay. Well, I'd like to direct the committee to the actual budget numbers. If we could just walk through those, and then we'll proceed with the next part of your presentation. Just
okay.
to focus on the actual numbers. Page 36, starting with the governor's 8.3.
Right.
9.7, if you could just walk us down those numbers and the percentage changes from 2012.
The only increase we have in all of our budgets here are for the across the board salary and health increases. So we go from the adjusted basis. The current request is 8.3974 for the whole program, and then you can see the spread there between personal services, travel, supplies and equipment.
So travel is, if you could just for the record, $266,000. It's down 20% from your actual 2012 services. What is included in that line item? $1.5 million.
Madam Chair, the travel number?
No, going down to services right below that.
the services, oh, the contractual services for this program are, generally speaking, the professional services contractors that we use to conduct assessment, cleanup, and monitoring. So it's the contractual money. We have a stable of term contractors. Most of the actual work is done through the private sector. And this is the line to 300 is the contractual money that's used to do that.
Okay. And then going down to the funding sources, if you could explain the breakdown of funding sources, $4,521,000 federal as the first one.
Yes, ma'am. The federal receipts is made up of funds coming from a variety of federal sources, and they're all lumped together here. But the breakout is leaky underground storage tank money, which comes from EPA to clean up leaky underground storage tank contaminated sites, is about $468,000. The brownfield sites, which is also EPA money, which is to restore and reuse sites in Alaska, is about $726,000. This detail I'm giving you is not in the purple book here, so, but it's the breakout for the $4.5 million. The Corps of Engineers is about $114,000, BLM is about $100,000, and our biggest piece is of that 4.2 is the DOD funding, which is $3.4 million.
Okay, and are all of those funding sources stable at this point?
Yes, Madam Chair, they vary. They've been relatively stable over the years. Alaska has historically had one of the highest contributions of DOD cleanup money of any state in the country. I think it peaked at like, one year it was like almost $250 million. I think we're down to like the $60 million total they put into it statewide. The money that comes to us is strictly the cost to the state for the oversight.
Okay. Interagency receipts, $92,000. And then the Oil and Hazardous Fund, $3.7 million, is that coming from the revenue off the larger oil spill response fund, or how where does that money come from? It looks like it's designated.
Yes, Madam Chair, the 3.7. Whenever you see the response fund here, it's called 1052 Oil Hazards Response Fund. That's actually coming from the prevention account in the response fund, and that's our funding source then out of the response fund.
And is that the fund that's running out?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And what is the balance of that fund?
Today, I don't know if I have that number. We'll cover. We have projections, projection sheets at the end of the thing here, and it'll be on that sheet.
Okay. Great. All right. I think that pretty well walks us through the numbers. Are there questions at this point before we proceed?
Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
The travel being, am I seeing that the travel is, for the new budget, is 20% less than, or 7.2% less than actual, compared to actual in 2012? Is that what, on the second line, they're under objects of expenditure. We get personal services, and then we have travel. Just trying to.
Representative, through the chair, yeah, that's down from the actual number at 287.2.
Madam Chair, follow up the. Why are we expecting travel to be less than we had in the actual last year?
These travel costs here, the reductions here. Our adjustments we make annually when we do our budget estimates.
Okay, thank you, Madam.
Okay. All right. Are you ready to move on then from the slide of the PowerPoint on page 13? So we left off at industry preparedness and pipeline operations.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. The industry preparedness program, and I'll try to be brief here because I know we're running out of time. Is on page 38. The numbers are on page 38 and 39 then of the purple book. And real briefly then, the industry preparedness, this program, what this program does is oversees the regulated entities in the state to ensure they have oil spill contingency plans and financial responsibility. They register our oil spill response contractors. We do drills and inspections. And a couple of the key issues then for this program is the aging infrastructure and the pipeline spills. Pipelines are about 80% of the oil gas infrastructure. And as you can see on the next slide here, we put a lot of emphasis on that since 2006. And the new numbers for these pipelines are looking real good since that time. The spills are down, the volumes are down, we're shooting for zero. Industry is putting a considerable effort into this, and we've been working closely with them to reduce spills from an infrastructure that, you know, we want to see running for another generation. Page 15 then, slide
Excuse
15,
me.
Just some of the accomplishments.
Mr. Dietrich, we have a question. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Representative Pruitt.
Well, can I ask you about that, about how much of the of the flow lines, the lines up there, are they having to replace because of the corrosion?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I'd have to get back to you on the number of actual replacement. Replacement is part of what they're doing. I mean, there's improved corrosion monitoring, there's management systems, more inspections, and pipeline replacement when it's called for is part of what's done then to the repairs. And but to get you an actual number of the number of miles or whatever replaced pipeline, I'd have to dig that out for you.
Can I just follow up then? Mm-hmm. What have we changed in a substantial way since the, whether it's the BP, the corrosion problem where they had the spill? What have we put in place since then to, of course, this is older infrastructure, and are we maintaining our level of course, increased, I'd assume we'd have to increase the continued monitoring because it's going to continue to corrode. That's just the nature of what's taking place. This is older pipeline as opposed to if we would replace it all, then you probably wouldn't have to be as stringent.
Yes, Representative Pruitt, through the chair, there's a number of things we've been looking at, and most a lot of these are with industry help. And as you're probably aware, we're collaborating. BP just contributed to the opening of a corrosion lab at the UAA, and we're working on an MOA with them to focus on metallurgical analysis and other things that will allow us a better capability to examine these corroding pipelines. But just a couple of brief points. There are improved integrity management activities that are occurring now to assess the effectiveness of the programs that are in place. There's a new focus now when we have a spill to do a root cause analysis to find out what's happened so that actions can be taken to see if it's systemic and corrective action can be taken. There's a new focus now on leading indicators in these corrosion management programs instead of looking at them after the fact. So in other words, what should we be monitoring for to tell us when a spill will happen before it happens? And so there's a lot of development in that. There's much improved data collection. I would say they're much more proactive now on their risk analysis methodologies to determine pipe condition, which tells you then whether or not there's a potential problem. And there's a much larger effort going into actual pipeline inspections in the field. So there's a combination of things, and it's a very dynamic situation because flow lines in particular are three-phase fluids, so they're the most corrosive of the fluids, and the state of Alaska is the only entity in the country that's even attempting to try to regulate the flow lines, and we think they're important because of the aging infrastructure, but flow lines are being used on an increasing basis in the state and they're key to new development because you can't put processing centers everywhere, so we're seeing like for offshore, that will be a long flow line that comes across. So it's a dynamic situation. There's a lot of energy going into the technology aspects to see how to best deal with these corrosion issues. So,
thank you.
Representative Kawasaki.
Just to follow up on this particular question, how much of that, the new regulations and stuff that you just mentioned, were specifically part of the 2013 settlement? And how much of it was agency redeveloping and changing its own internal regulations?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, the state actually identified the problem with the flow lines actually in the 90s, and we first initiated some corrective action through what they call the charter agreement, That was filed then by regulation development, which we actually completed in, I think it was 2006. The 2013 settlement that occurred is simply the end result of the litigation over the 2006 spill. And that money was just received recently.
So to clarify, none of the, I mean, there was nothing written in the settlement that changed the way we do business in regards to transit lines and...
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, no, the settlement agreement itself did not impose any new requirements. Those are underway in the regulatory arena, pretty heavy duty after 2006, and there's been a continuous large effort, both part of the state and the industry, to get on top of that issue and stay on top of it.
Representative Staton.
Thank you. When the useful life of pipelines or facilities are estimated when things are built, and we extend past the useful life, what criteria do we use to require that those be replaced, or do we have any requirement that when useful life is established, or do we just monitor and try to get ahead of time, but useful life and...
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yeah, I mean, you'll talk to some engineers, and a piece of pipe can carry food. As long as you take care of it, it'll last forever, you know. So if you manage that correctly, yeah, you can extend the life without a problem. So if your management systems are up to speed and you're watching corrosion rates and stuff, and as long as you have pipeline integrity, you can continue to use it. Perhaps an example here is the federal government has a standard for 80% wall loss. When you get an 80% wall loss, so your monitoring system detects wall loss, right? And if you have wall loss more than 80%, then you've got a structural issue, then you've got to stop and replace. So there's ways to deal with that to continue the operation. It requires more investment and more involvement and more monitoring and more scrutiny, but it is possible with that additional effort to stay on top of the condition and continue to use it.
I'd like to hold off on questions until the end because we have a lot of material to get through, and I really want to have some time for the discussion on the response fund and some of the challenges that we face. So if you can continue, please.
Okay, Madam Chair. So we were on the industry preparedness program, and I think we're on slide 15, correct?
Yeah.
And so this is just the highlights, again, of some of the activities carried out by the program. Again, this is for the last fiscal year. The number of contingency plan actions, inspections, drills, storage tank repairs, underground inspections, engineering reviews, and we did host, again, in an effort to look at the technology issues, we did have a pipeline leak detection best available technology conference, and that was to seek the best information possible for improving leak detection on pipelines. Slide 16 then, again, these are the measures that are involved with this program, two of the measures. We try to get our inspections and drills at our what we call our high-risk facilities, which are facilities that we rank them based on the type of product, the volume, past compliance issues, the receiving environment, and other factors. So we're a little bit short on that. We got about 65%. In terms of inspection drills at high-risk facilities, our target is 100%, and for our low-risk facilities, then we would like to hit 20% of those annually. We're hitting the low end, but we're not hitting yet the high end, and we need more effort there. The second performance measure then is again the spills from regulated facilities. Are substantially reduced. Our goal is a 10% goal here is a number here. We had one exception in 2010, which was from a spill from a fuel tank out in ADAC. Otherwise, we're coming close to that goal. Slide 17, then, is the operating budget. So that's page 38 and 39 in the purple book. And the total budget for this program is $5.0 million. The funding sources are made up of 669,000 is unrestricted GF. We have 415,000 in designated GF, and then 3.2 million that comes out of the response fund. The other state funds, the sources are the 424 is from our RSA for our oversight of the TAPS pipeline that comes through the Joint Pipeline Office. And we get federal receipts in this program to implement the underground storage tank program for EPA in the amount of $304,000. The numbers for the line item breakouts, you can see personal services is $4.2 million, travel of $137,000, contractual services of $598,000, and then commodities are at $47.3. Moving on then, prevention and emergency response program. This is our actual, and this begins in the book. I'll talk about what the program does first, but pages 40 and 41. They actually respond to all of the spills. They oversee the statewide hazmat response. We have a very good hazmat response capability in the state of Alaska now. They conduct drills and exercises. They prepare the government response plans. We have 50 or so local response agreements, and this program also coordinates our disaster response coordination. Challenges for them are we continue to enhance the local readiness. We want to continue to keep the statewide hazmat capability viable. The new emerging thing for this program is, again, Arctic shipping and offshore oil and gas exploration and development and the planning and response for that. Slide 19 then, the response considerations is difficult. We try to maintain a capability to respond 24/7 to any spill at any location at any time in the state of Alaska. So logistics are a huge part of getting out to the areas. Weather and climate risks, I don't need to go into that. I think everybody knows that. There is an expectation now, though, when we have a spill in the state that, yeah, it's immediately responded to and we try to hit that goal. And then slide 20 is some of their accomplishments for FY 2012. The number of spill reports and the number of responses. There's 23 that we classified as significant for 2012. There was about 30 oil spills and drills, the Alaska Shield exercises. We prepare local geographic response strategies in areas where we don't have them. We maintain the response plans. And because of the increased shipping risks and the spills from these increased shipping in the state of Alaska, we have four marine vessel risk assessments going on in the state of Alaska now. There's a large one in the Aleutians. We have one going on in Cook Inlet. There's going one underway for the Bering Straits, which is the gateway to shipping to and from the Arctic. And we've initiated a vessel traffic study for the new Panamax ships that will be visiting southeast. Measures for this program, we try to hit 100% cleanup. We don't want to add to the legacy contamination issues. We're not doing too bad in that regard. And we're 99% in terms of complete without any further monitoring. Some of these, you can get them all cleaned up. Some of them require monitoring. We like to get them completely cleaned up and then not hand any off as a contaminated site. And we're not doing too bad in that regard. Budget numbers for this program are a little bit easier. Again, it's on page 40 and 41. Program budget of $4.3 million. A single funding source for this program. This is all from the response fund from the prevention account. And the breakouts, as you can see, for salary there is $3.6 million, travel of $114,000, contractual services of $563,000, and commodities of $50,000. And they do a little bit of capital outlays in a way of response gear and equipment. And that's it for that one. Last program then, which is on pages 42 and 43, is the response fund. So this is a group of five people that oversee, that conduct all of our cost recovery and manage the response fund and the accounts in the fund. They also manage our contracts. They staff the finance section. When we have a large response, they prepare the biennial response fund report to the legislature with accounts in detail for every expenditure, and they run our information databases. Some of their accomplishments or statistics are on the next slide. We billed 1,756 responsible parties in 2012 for $2.7 million. We issued 54 notices to proceed for cleanup with a contract value of $4.2 million. They managed $3.3 million in reimbursable services agreement, and they coordinated $6.4 million in funding associated with 21 grants. Again, their numbers are on page 40. Let's see. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. We skipped the performance measures here. Here we go. Yeah, their first performance measure there is our target is to make sure we bill 80% of all of our costs and get that recovery. The target is to ultimately achieve, and the second one there is to get 100% back of state costs that are spent on spill response and restore it to the fund. Yeah, and the last one is their numbers there, their budget numbers. You can see $1.4 million from the response fund and $42.4 million in federal receipts. The numbers off pages 42 in their budget, personal services of $494,000, travel of $5.4 million. And the contractual money of $1.1 million, and that's made up primarily of money from the fund that we RSA to other agencies that participate in the state response. And that's the end of the four programs. The next slide here then is the response fund. And I will go through that now. First, let me point out that there are two major accounts. There's actually six accounts in the fund. This slide highlights the two major, the primary accounts. The first account is the $50 million account. It's funded by a 1 cent surcharge on oil. The 1 cent surcharge is off now. If the balance exceeds $50 million, the tax goes off. If the balance is below $50 million, it automatically kicks on. This pays for this is the reserve that was established by the legislature for response to imminent and substantial threats. We do cost recovery, and the money that's paid out by the state is restored to this account. The second large account is the prevention account. This is funded currently by the 4 cent surcharge, and it pays for the operational costs of the division. Now, here's the slide where it all comes together. It's a little bit busy, but over the years we've tried to portray the whole thing. So I'll just walk through this quickly. There's a red line down the middle.
Excuse me, Mr. Dietrich.
Yes.
We have a question.
Sorry to interrupt. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Is this the same as the one that's in there?
Yes.
Okay, just want to make sure there wasn't a reason to look at one or the other. Thank you.
So you see the red line here down the middle. So to the left of the red line is the $50 million response account. The whole thing is referred to as the Oil and Hazardous Substance Release Prevention and Response Fund. So going from the top on the left under response and going down, there are three accounts within the response side of the fund. The first account is the surcharge account. So the money that is collected when the tax is on, okay, is deposited into the surcharge account. The second box going vertically down is the response mitigation account. So the funds that we recover from the parties that have a spill are deposited into this account. Okay? The $50 million account is the last account at the bottom. So that's where the principal is. The legislature, through the appropriation process, moves the money from the surcharge accounts and the response mitigation accounts into the response account. And then at the lower end there is just the annotated uses of this for emergency uses, which is basically means it can be used for, it's for the large significant responses. There's also an arrow there showing that the legislature can and does have the authority, if they so choose, to use it for other purposes, and they have done so on occasion. Moving to the right then, it's the same structures. There's three accounts on the right. So the 4 cent surcharge is collected in the surcharge account on an annual basis. The second box is the prevention mitigation account. So when we were talking about the recent BP settlement, that's where that settlement went. Both of those then are appropriated to the prevention account, which is where, which is the funding source then for the division. And that's the account then that has the dwindling balance. So the legislative arrows there again, the appropriation process is what moves the money from those two accounts into the prevention account on the prevention side. And the listing at the bottom is just an annotated list then of the activities that are carried out with prevention account funds.
Are there questions at this point? Representative Seaton.
When was the $50 million cap put on the surcharge account for the response fund?
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. This account structure was created by the legislature in 1994. The one originally, it was originally passed, you'll notice, it was originally created actually back in 76. It morphed into, went through a couple of different structures, and then 86, you've heard this account referred to as HB 470. And then HB 470 was the bill passed in 1986 that created the this response account as a single account. In 1990 then, following the Exxon Valdez event, is when then they created a single account with the nickel a barrel surcharge, and it all went into a single account. And that single account then was to be the operating funds to pay for, there was probably 15 spill bills passed by the legislature after that event. And they created a nickel a barrel into a single account that was to be used for both response and the operating costs to implement these 15, the fiscal notes on some 15 pieces of legislation. That was then changed in 1995, so the single nickel a barrel was split into 3 cent, 2 cent in 1995. And that's when the two counts were created. So it went from one account to a $50 million response account and then an operating account, which they call a prevention account, in 1995. The nickel was split and 2 cents went towards the $50 million, and that's when they set the threshold for above or below, tax on or off. And then the 3 cent went into the prevention account. That bill passed without the governor's signature because that was a point in time when we actually entered into our structural underfunding. The 3 cent was a 40% reduction over what was originally passed by the legislature. So it simply was not enough to pay for all the programs. And so we've actually been tracking that ever since 95 and making adjustments each and every year to try to deal then with the original balance that was put in there. It just keeps going down, but the revenue of the 3 cent was simply not enough to keep up. The legislature then in 2006 increased it from 3 cents to 4 cents, and that's what got us to where we're at today.
Representative Pruitt.
Can I go a little deeper on that then? So the 50 million, and I'm trying to make sure I understand this, we just suspended in 2013. How it took us that amount of time to get it to 50 million, or I mean, because it sounds like if we expend money out of it, we're going to get that money back. So it should stay always at some sort of level of 50 million. So at this point, should we expect it at any point in time, should that 1 cent be charged in the future if we've already hit that threshold?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair. Yeah, in 95 when they created the account, they took the balance that was in that original account they created in 1990, and it was quite a bit of money. And they took $47 million out of the balance of the single account, and they put it into the response account.
Okay.
And it had, at that time then, the 2 cent feature. The 2 cent kicked on because it wasn't quite a 50. It rapidly went up to 50. The tax shut off. So it went above 50. It was probably 96 or something like that, and has remained above 50 until the 2006 spill. And there was a draw made on it that it took the balance down. That kicked the 1 cent tax on, And the 1 cent tax then is just taken from then, from that point in time essentially now, to get it back up over 50 so that it was shut off again.
And just to continue on that, then the recuperated cost from 2006 should actually put it quite a bit over 50 million, correct? If we've been collecting that 1 cent and we recuperate the costs that we expend.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Pruitt, through the chair, the way the structure of the count is set up, the statute directs that the cost from the recount, the state costs, be deposited back in the response mitigation account, which is what was done. So our response costs were fairly small in terms of the total final settlement, which includes fines and penalties. The statute directs that the fines and penalty portion be deposited into the prevention mitigation account. So the $10 million expenditure, which just recently came in the door, goes in the prevention mitigation account. And the 1 cent tax has restored the response account along with our cost recovery of our actual costs.
Okay, and I just want to clarify. I'm still a little confused on that. Just because I understand it sounds like that we recuperate the costs and majority, like the fines and penalties, go into prevention. But the actual cost that, or the actual amount that comes out of the response account, mm-hmm. that we're recuperating, if I read this correct, cost recovery, and we get some of it. I mean, are we recovering everything that we pull out of the response account?
Representative, through the chair, all of our state direct costs, yeah, I don't know if we're at 100%, but we're fairly close to it on the response account side.
Okay, so then if we took it out, the 1 cent kicked in, we were filling it up after we had expended it, mm-hmm. then we recover that cost. It should put that above the 50 million if we're at 50 million, right?
Again, Representative Pruitt, through the chair, yeah, there's lag times involved in terms of when the cost recovery occurs and when it gets deposited back in, and then it's only acted upon by the legislature annually, so it takes another year then to appropriate back in the account. So it's just a function of when those checks come in for the cost recovery, when the 1 cent kicks on, and when the balance, and that calculation and that accounting is done by the Department of Administration. They keep the official records on that. But that's what it is. It's really a timing issue. I think our average lag time for cost recovery, if we had to calculate one, is probably about 3 years after the fact. For big ones, it's longer, and for this one, it's longer than that. But it's a combination of those factors of the timing of when it gets restored and returned.
Okay, and I'll have more questions later. But
okay, yeah. Representative Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess what Representative Pruitt's trying to ask is, what's the AR? In other words, what's the outstanding debt, I mean, that we're looking to receive that's out there still that we haven't, you know, collected yet? What's that total amount?
Yes, Representative Higgins, through the chair, we can tally that for you. I don't have
that. That'd be nice to know what we got. The other question I've got, because I'm a little, if you don't mind follow-up, a little confused here. We have a 4 cents surcharge per barrel of oil going into the prevention account, correct?
That's correct.
Correct. All right. But yet we're saying that we're losing money on that end. It's running out of money. If you look at your what page was that? Oh, right here. I'm looking at page 30 on your handout here. By year 2022, we're going to have $4,700,000 in that. Is that calculation because of loss of production? Is that what you're looking at?
Yes, Representative Higgins, through the chair, if we want, we can. I can walk you through this slide right here. So the top line on this projection here is the amount generated by the 4 cent surcharge, and that's based on Department of Revenue production forecasts. So that top line, $7 million, $6 million, going on out to FY22, is the revenue that's anticipated to be generated by the 4 cent surcharge. The next line is the cost recovery fines and penalties has been standardized. You can see in FY14 reflects the injection of the large settlement from the 2006 incident. It's otherwise normalized and projected at $1.5 million a year. Now that can fluctuate. There can be a lot of variation in it. The third line then is investment income, and that's also been standardized for purpose of the projection at $1.2 million a year. Investment income itself has, on the account, has been as low as, I think, about $600,000 and as high as $7 million. We're in a period right now where the investment income, which is the interest earned by the principals in these accounts, which is managed by Treasury, they invest that along with other state accounts, has been very poor. So, you know, a multi-million dollar fluctuation in interest income in any given year is very difficult to deal with. And then the cost recovery and fines and penalties can also be highly variable in any given year. You can see that by FY14 when you all of a sudden you get a settlement check, you know, some 8 or 10 years later. The variation is offset by the principal that's in the prevention account. And so that's the cushion. And when the cushion is gone, then there's no more cushion left then to offset those that variation, and that's what causes the problem. And this projection shows now that the problem will occur in FY15, if based on these assumptions.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Back to Representative Pruitt's question. If we can go back a slide or two. Yeah, this one. I thought I was okay on this until you were asking questions. So the cap on the surcharge account isn't, you know, related to the balance of the response account, because the response account is also going to include what came in from response mitigation, right, for cost recovery. So that there's not a relationship there. The surcharge account is always going to be charging the 1 cent until it gets to 50 million?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, that's correct.
Okay.
So that's in statute that when it goes, that's an automatic process. The Department of Administration calculates. So whenever the balance, and they calculate it, I think, on a quarterly basis.
Uh-huh.
So they take a quarterly number, and if it's below, then the tax gets on. They calculate again the next quarter. If it's above, then the tax switches off. And that's all automatic.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. $50 million, you know, if we have a responsible party, a big oil company or something, we can pretty much get response money from them on a, mm-hmm. I mean, that's been the history. With the increased shipping in the Arctic and the potential of spills there that might not have that same responsible party availability, what is, and with inflation eating that $50 million and what it lets us do, how does that $50 million cap relate today to the risks that we have versus when it was established in 94?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. Yeah. The $50 million, this again, my recollection of when it was established was based, the legislature wanted to decide an amount of money that was enough to front-end the expenditures the state would incur for a large response. And it's related to the 89 event. What happened in 89 is it happened during session. And there were two $20 million appropriations done, because at the time that event occurred, the account that existed at that time, which is the HB 470 version, it was a single account. There was only $1 million in it. So it wasn't enough to launch what was necessary. The two $20 million appropriations then allowed the state to fully engage, so that was $40 million. So when they created the split account, they were trying to figure out an amount of money that was a sufficient threshold such that the state could launch the response, do what they needed to do to a large event, and by the time that was necessary so that the legislature was not in session, there was enough time for them to call a session to come together to appropriate then whatever further amount may be needed beyond the $50 million. So is it the right amount? It's not, so I guess to answer your question, is it risk-based? Well, in a way, I think, but I think my recollection of the intent was it was to cover the bases so that the state could do what it needed to do if the legislature was not there, and they could have the time then, week, 2 weeks, whatever it takes then, to call a special session, convene, and do what they need to do.
I guess just following up, it seems like, you know, in the 89 event, we had a very responsible party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, although there were those appropriations, that was actually funding that. Same things happened with the BP spill in the Gulf. They stepped forward to the plate. I'm worried in the Arctic. We have, you know, severe conditions. We have a long ways away. The response is going to be very expensive. And I'm concerned that with the change in potential responsible parties and not being able to get those, you know, I mean, if it's a Russian ship or somebody else's ship from a Panamanian registered ship, that $50 million might not be enough to cover. And so
yes, Representative Pruitt.
Has there been any consideration at some time, because it looks like, of course, 5 cents has been in place from what you're mentioning there, at least the total, including the two, has been in place since, you know, for about 20 years. Of course, like anything, 5 cents doesn't buy as much as it did 20 years ago. But has there been any consideration of the fact that they pay the 5 cents, they kind of there's an expectation that it's already there. It's probably figured into the cost structures of the individuals paying this, to make it so that once we hit the $50 million cap, that 1 cent automatically goes into the other account, not the prevention, but the response account. If we get under 50 million, then it goes back to putting the one cent back into the 1 cent goes back into the response account, and then once we hit the 50 million, it directly goes right back into the prevention account.
No.
But could it? Have you considered that, right?
Yeah.
Is that the question?
Has there been any consideration of maybe making that happen?
No, there's been a number of proposals to look at. Some of the proposals have been one was to increase the principal, the $50 million account, from the standpoint it would generate more interest, and then the increased revenue stream from the interest. And that was looked at, and that was one alternative. And another alternative was to go to Treasury and have them invest it in a more aggressive instrument than this fixed income, which is very low. And that was also debated and thought that the risk, well, gee, you don't want to have a response then, right, when the market's down, because you may not be there. So those were looked at and ruled out. I don't think the specific proposal, if I understand what you're saying, is which is to have the 1 cent feed the prevention account after it hits 50 million.
Once it hits 50 million.
I don't recall that specifically being proposed, no.
And so follow up on that, I mean, we can have some fun with our accounting. We could move $25 million from response into prevention and just have the 1 cent kicked back in. The question is, ultimately the goal here is that there's more oil going through the pipeline and we don't have the problem with the prevention account not having the 4 cents go into it. We're getting less and less and less. I understand that what the root cause and concern here is, but until we figure that piece out, there's a concern that we're ultimately this money is going to come from the same people that we'd be pulling the 1 cent from. I mean, 93%, right, of our budget will come from oil and gas this year, right? It's going to come from them anyways. So, I mean, it might be something to think about where if the 5 cent is of course, this is something we have to work on. If the 5 cents is already included in the way that they are planning their investments, let's just continue that going instead of the back and forth. And I know that's an characteristic thing for me to say, but obviously this money is going to have to come from somewhere. And they have that in their cost analysis already. So something to think about.
How much does the 1 cent generate in a year?
Okay, 1 cent will generate, I don't remember these off to my head, will generate at 500,000 barrels a day, about 1.6 million annually. Okay. 1 cent a barrel at 600,000 barrels a day will generate about $1.9 million annually.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it doesn't solve the problem, but it's a piece of the whole thing.
Right. Representative Kawasaki and then Representative Seaton.
Just a straight question. So Legislative Finance Division says that the Oil and Hazardous Substance Release Prevention and Response Fund is inadequate in the long term. You've said it, and we've heard from the division or department and division over several years that it's also inadequate. OMB, the OMB response to that was that we have to do two things, and that the balance of the funds clear, either increase production or utilize general funds to address the shortfall in the interim. And I just want to hear from you, is the Oil and Hazardous Substance Release Prevention and Response Fund adequate to meet the needs into the future? And then two, what do we do about it from your perspective?
Yes, Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. Well, as the projection shows, we go negative for FY15, so we have to do something F15. We do these projections every year because of the variables and income and everything. You have to redo these every year until the picture changes. Does something have to happen? Yeah, something has to happen. So we worked with OMB closely there on what to do, and production is a key piece of that. If production rolls back up and there is a target back to 1 million barrels a day, that would be wonderful for for all of us. And you can, so the amount of time it would take to get that number, of course, is a little soft. But in working with OMB, their current proposal, and that's what has been put back before the legislature, is to use GF, to inject GF, then do the annual projection, see what the shortage is. We have to do this a year ahead of time because it accumulates for a year and it's not available then until the following fiscal year. But to do that on an annual basis and inject the GF into the prevention account then to cover the shortage, and then as the production comes up, that will be reduced, then the injections would be reduced, and hopefully then at a million barrels would be closer to a steady state. So they've estimated, and we did get intent language from Senator Lisa McGuire on that last year. There's a formal response that we can provide to you if you don't have it, from OMB to her letter to come up with just such a plan. That's what that plan says, is that in anticipation of for 15, based on these projections, I think it's in the order of $6 million would be a GF injection, and that's their proposed fixed.
I mean, my question was, Madam Chair, is that that's their financial analysis in order to meet that. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. Office of Management and Budget does that. What's your policy fix? Do you have a policy fix? Have you considered any other changes to this prevention and response fund? Because we've heard a couple of things battered around, but I guess we still haven't heard it from the department.
Yes, Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, departments looked at, there have been many moves taken in anticipation of this problem over the years that have actually extended the life up to FY15. So we've been talking about this for more than a decade. The legislature has already taken a number of moves to take the situation, and that's been in discussion with us about the different options that are available. There were some appropriations being done for other activities that were not allowed uses of the funds. Those were discontinued in 2006. The surcharge was increased from 3 cents to 4 cents in the same mode to do that. And our capital budget requests, we got intent language probably 3 years or so ago, was to discontinue use of the response fund for like state-owned contamination. And so that has been done. The sum total of those things then has literally been in the millions. Our actual expenditures have also been reduced. We've had a number of increments since 2006, and I think the net on that is about $895,000 in reduced expenditures. And in addition, we've looked at the other things here, the investment income, increasing the principal in the account, getting more aggressive with that investment income, or substituting other fund sources for specific programs. For example, like when the full line incident occurred, there was an increment to bring on the engineers to actually do the work, and that was GF was used instead of response fund, again, in recognition of the declining balance issue. So sum total is there's been a lot of moves and shifts made to get us to where we're at, and the number of options are getting smaller.
We have time for two more quick questions, Representative Seaton and then Representative Tarr, and then we are out of time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm looking at the declining balance and the number that was 1.6 to 1.9 if there was a 100,000 barrel mm-hmm. increase. Obviously, even at 4 cents, that means that's a total of 1.2 if we went up with 100,000 barrels. And I haven't seen any proposals from any 10-year projections, other than if shale oil would all of a sudden, that there's any real possibility of doing that. So most of this looks like it's from inflation. In other words, expenses are inflating it more than the amount that we're getting into there. So it's not just on reduction of funding, it's things cost more, and of course the price of oil has gone up significantly. So I guess I'm not seeing how we look at this and saying we're not really looking at the majority of this being caused by inflation, and unless we change that amount, we really don't get at inflation. We don't, you know, it's not tied to the price, or it's not tied to revenue, it's simply tied to barrels which aren't inflated. So I guess I'd like to see some proposal that would come forward and actually mitigate the decline on realistic numbers. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Tarr. Thank you, Madam Chair. And similarly, you know, you said the 1 cent at 500,000 is 1.6 million a year, because we were kind of thinking the same thing that Lance, Representative Pruitt just suggested in terms of, you know, is there a way to maintain that 5 cent per barrel influx that we were getting until it was suspended, you know, this or in January. You know, what kind of impact would that have relative to the size of the fund? You know, it seems small. Maybe you can get that information and get it back to us. You know, is there some number of years, if it was done for 2 years and sunsetted, mm-hmm. how does that help or something like that?
And we'll work with you to get that information for the committee, because that's an excellent point. Thank you for bringing that up. We are out of time right now. Thank you for the presentation. It was very informative. There were some questions that came up on outstanding recoverable spill costs. Are there additional costs that have not been recovered? That came from Representative Higgins. And then we would like to see the OMB response to Senator McGuire's letter. And I think you can hear from around the table that there's great interest in coming up with some ideas and proposals on how to extend the life of the fund. If you could also provide detail on the 5 cent, keeping the 5 cent a barrel charge continuous and not, you know, not having it come off at the $50 million mark, what that would do to the fund over time. I think those were the questions that I heard. I will be working with you on ideas that we can bring forward to the full finance committee to help extend the life of this fund. The next meeting is Tuesday the 12th, 8:30 a.m. We will hear from Tom Cherian, Director of the Division of Administrative Services, and Elaine Floyd, Director of Division of Environmental Health. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.